wall where spice bins had once hung and worked on a solution to the problem of Berkeley. If we could capture the cat, we could rig some kind of protective exoskeleton, Lawrence said. He's suffered enough, Patricia said. I don't want to torture him any more by prodding him and attaching some kind of gear to his body. If I knew how to build nanomachines, I would make a swarm of them follow him around and form a shield when he was in distress. But my best attempts at nanomotors were sort of, lazy. You wouldn't like lazy nanobots. They caught a glimpse of Berkeley in the unilluminable darkness of the Spice House's upper attic, behind a great support beam. A glimmer of fur, a bright pair of eyes. Another time, Berkeley ran down the stairs just as they threw themselves in his path. The two children wound up in a bruised heap at the bottom of the stairwell. Listen, Patricia said from the bottom of the stairs. Tommington was a good cat. I didn't have anything against him. He was just doing his cat thing. I never meant him any harm, I swear. There was no response. Maybe you should do a spell, said Lawrence. Do some magic or something. I don't know. Patricia felt sure Lawrence was laughing at her, but he didn't have that kind of guile. She would have seen it on his face. I'm serious, Lawrence said. This seems like a magic kind of problem, if there ever was one. But I don't know how to do anything, Patricia said. I mean, the only time I did anything magic-y in years was when I ate too much spicy food. I've tried every kind of spice 100 times since then. But maybe you didn't need to be able to do anything those other times, Lawrence said. And now you do. Berkeley watched them from atop a bookcase full of Patricia's mother's productivity assessment books. He was ready to flee, fast as a bullet train, if they came too close. I wish we could just go into the woods and find that magic tree, Patricia said. But my parents would kill me if they found out, and I know Roberta would tell them. I don't think we need to go into the woods, said Lawrence, still eager to avoid the outdoors. From what you told me before, the power is inside you. You just need to get at it. Patricia looked at Lawrence, who wasn't in any way screwing with her, and she couldn't imagine ever having a better friend in the world. She went back up to the attic, where it was always way hotter than the rest of the Spice House, and listened to her own breathing. She looked like a bird to herself, her body so tiny and hollow-boned. Lawrence and Berkeley were both watching to see what she was going to do. Berkeley even crept a little closer along a ceiling beam. Okay, now or never. She imagined that this hot attic was a jungle, and the dry beams were fruitful trees, and the boxes of old clothes were lush undergrowth. She couldn't go to the forest. She couldn't count on astral projecting a second time. Fine. She would bring the forest to her. She breathed the scents of long-ago chests of saffron and turmeric, and she imagined a million branches splaying over their heads, endless limbs as far as they could see in any direction. She tried to remember the sound of Tommington's speech long ago, and tried to speak to Berkeley the same way, as close as she could manage. She had no clue what she was doing, and if she stopped a second to think about what a nut she looked like, she would die. She was talking under her breath, but she got a little louder. Berkeley crept closer, his tongue between 2 pointy teeth. Patricia swayed a little and reached deep in her throat for a grumbling, raucous sound. Berkeley's ears pricked up. Berkeley was definitely coming over, and Patricia grew louder. He was almost within grabbing distance if she wanted to grab him, which she didn't. "You speak cat?" Berkeley said, his eyes ginormous. "Sometimes," Patricia couldn't help laughing with relief, "sometimes I speak cat."
"You're that mean girl," Berkeley said. "You tricked Uncle Tommington."
"I didn't mean to," Patricia said. "I was trying to help a bird."
"Birds taste good,"
Berkeley observed, bouncing on his front paws a little. They flap around and try to fly out of your paws. They are like toys with meat inside.
This bird was a friend of mine, Patricia said.
A friend?
Berkeley struggled with the concept that you could be friends with a bird. What was next, holding conversations with your catfish?
Yes, I protect my friends, no matter what. I would like to be your friend.
Berkeley bristled a little bit.
I don't need any protection. I am a strong, fierce cat.
Sure, of course. Maybe you can protect me, then.
Maybe I can.
Berkeley came over and curled up in Patricia's lap.
I did it!
She turned to look at Lawrence, grinning with her whole face, and realized he was looking kind of shell-shocked. Lawrence just stared, then shuddered a little.
Sorry, Patricia said. Was that weird?
Berkeley was purring in her lap, like a bandsaw. Kind of. Yeah, Lawrence said. His shoulders were a scaffolding around his ears.
Good weird or bad weird?
Just weird. Weirdness is value neutral. I should go. See you at school.
Lawrence fled, almost as fast as Berkeley might have, before Patricia could say anything else. She couldn't go after him. She finally had a purring cat in her lap. Her familiar.
Damn.
She'd hoped this wasn't going to be freaky. What kind of dumbass was she, doing magic like that in front of an outsider? It had been his idea, true, but still. She started petting Berkeley.
We're just going to protect each other. Okay?
He showed no sign that he could still understand her, but whatever. She had finally done a proper spell. On purpose, this time. Chapter 8 Lawrence's cheap jack lunch tray wobbled, sagging under the weight of so much undercooked starch, as he tried to figure out where to sit, as far away from Patricia Delphine as possible. She sat there, in their usual spot, near the compost and trash bins, trying to catch his eye, one brow raised under her messy bangs. The longer he stood, the less stable his tray felt, and the more she seemed to squirm in the corner of his eye. Finally, Lawrence took a sharp left and went to sit on the back steps, near where the skaters skateboarded after school, perching the plastic tray on his knees. It was technically against the rules to eat out here, but who cared? He kept thinking he should try to talk to Patricia, but then he would remember the weirdness. The image of her shimmying around and doing that thing with her hands, and then having a dialogue with her pet in cat noises for an uncomfortable length of time, was enough to make Lawrence dry heave. He pictured the two of them hanging out and Patricia offering to talk to the local wildlife on his behalf, maybe doing her heebie-jeebie dance again. The whispers Lawrence had been hearing about Patricia around the school felt much more relevant now that he'd seen her in action. Lately, he'd been finding any excuse to sit near the graceful, long-limbed Dorothy Glass, and he heard Dorothy and her friends sharing a whole mythos about that girl who kept frogs in her locker. People still thought Lawrence was dating Patricia, no matter how he denied it. He couldn't help remembering Patricia's warning about witch cooties. Hey! Patricia came out the back door and stood right behind him, casting a shadow in his face as he tried to eat his buttery potato wedges. Lawrence kept chewing.
Hey!
Patricia said again, angrier this time.
Hey!
Lawrence didn't turn around.
What's going on? Why are you ignoring me? Seriously, please talk to me. This is driving me nuts.
The shadow over Lawrence flickered and changed shape because Patricia was gesturing.
It was your idea, You suggested it, and then I did it, and you freaked out and bailed. Who treats their friends that way?
We shouldn't talk about this at school, Lawrence said very quietly, using his fork as the opposite of a microphone.
Okay, Patricia said.
So when do you want to talk about this?
I just want to keep my head down, Lawrence said, until I can get out of this place. That's all I want.
An ant stumbled, hoisting Lawrence's breadcrumb. Maybe Patricia could give it a pep talk in ant language.
I thought you hated your parents because they just want to keep their heads down.
Lawrence felt a weird combination of shame and rage, as though he'd grown another new body part just in time to get punched in it. He seized his tray and pushed his way past Patricia, not caring if he got potato dregs on himself or on her, and hurried back inside. And of course, someone saw him rushing in the hallway with a half-laden tray and stuck out a leg to trip him up. He ended up face down in his own muck. It never failed.
Later that day, Brad Chomner tried to cram Lawrence's entire body into a single-file urinal, and then both Brad and Lawrence got hauled into Mr. Dibbs's office for fighting, as if they were equal instigators. Mr. Dibbs called Lawrence's parents to come get him.
"That school is crushing the life out of me," Lawrence told his parents at dinner. "I need to get out of there. I've already filled out the application form to transfer to the math and science school, and I just need you guys to sign it."
He slid it onto the chipped formica table, where it sat amidst the faded placemats.
"We're just not sure you're mature enough to go to school in the city by yourself," Lawrence's dad carved into his casserole with the edge of his fork, making little snuffling noises with his nose and mouth. "Mr. Dibbs is concerned that you're a disruptive influence. Just because you get good grades, snarf, snorf, doesn't mean you can be a bad element."
"You haven't proved you can handle the responsibility you already have," said Lawrence's mother. "You can't make trouble all the time."
"Your mother and I don't make trouble," said Lawrence's father. "We make other things, because we're adults."
"What?"
Lawrence shoved his casserole away and took a heavy swig of cola instead.
"What do you make, exactly? Either of you guys?"
"Don't talk back," said Lawrence's father.
"This isn't about us," said Lawrence's mother.
"No, I want to know. It occurs to me I have no clue what either of you produces."
Lawrence looked at his dad. "You're a lower-middle manager who denies people's insurance claims for a living."
He looked at his mom.
"You update instruction manuals for obsolete machinery. What do either of you make?"
"We put a roof over your head," his father said.
"And delicious liver and peas casserole on your plate," his mother said.
"Oh, Jesus."
Lawrence had never talked to his parents like this before, and he didn't know what had come over him.
"You have no idea how hard I pray not to turn out like you two. My every nightmare, every one, is about turning into a complacent failure like you both. You don't even remember the dreams you threw away to sink into this hole."
And with that, he pushed his chair hard enough to scar the cheap linoleum and got upstairs before his parents could send him to his room or try to muster some fake outrage. He locked the door. Lawrence wished Isabel and her rocketeer friends would come and take him away. She was helping to run a start-up aerospace company that was actually making deliveries to the space station, and he kept reading articles where she was quoted about the brave new future of space travel. After Lawrence flopped onto his bed and gazed up at his ceiling-wide poster, in which every fictional spaceship congregated at a massive nebula, he remembered how he'd spoken to his parents. If he strained to listen over the dozen cooling fans along one wall of his bedroom, he could hear his parents fighting. Not the kind of fight where anybody hopes to win, or even find some solution. This was hopeless, pointless, mindless aggression.
two creatures caught in a trap with nothing to do but tear each other apart. Lawrence wanted to die. His mother sounded more wounded, his father more fatalistic, but they had identical levels of bitterness. Lawrence put a pillow over his head. It did no good. He wound up putting his headphones on, with the latest girl trash songs that everybody was listening to at school, and then a pair of winter earmuffs over them. Now he could no longer hear his parents, but he could still imagine what they were saying. He focused on the crooning, growling voice of the girl trash singer, whose name was Hetta Necco, and he found himself with an erection. Ignoring it did as much good as ignoring these things ever did. He hated himself, even as he let one hand drift down and carry out the motion he'd practiced incessantly of late. Just as Lawrence splashed onto a dirty fast-food napkin, he both heard and felt one of his parents slamming the front door of their house. He didn't know which. "I wish I were dead and in hell," Lawrence thought. Lawrence didn't sleep much. The next morning, he felt too sick for school, but he knew better than to ask to stay home. He barely noticed when kids threw erasers at him or refused to let him sign their petition to save something or other, because if he signed it, then nobody else would. When Lawrence got home that afternoon, he found the form sitting on the kitchen table, signed by both parents. Neither was home. At dinner, he tried to thank them, but they just shrugged and looked at the table. The three of them ate in total silence. The next day, Lawrence just stood in the hallway, watching it drain of people. He realized his buttons were buttoned wrong, so his jacket was askew. Patricia came up to him in the hallway. "You're going to be late," she said. "They're going to kill you." For the first time ever, Lawrence noticed that Patricia was pretty. Her skin had a brightness underlying its faint tan, like an airbrushed picture he'd seen once. Her neck was really smooth and graceful, and her wrist pivoted as she held her backpack on her shoulder. Her dark hair fell almost over one gray-green eye. He wanted to grab her by the shoulders. He wanted to run away from her. He wanted to kiss her. He wanted to scream. Instead, he said, "Do you want to ditch school?" "Why?" she said. "And go where?" "Let's go to the woods," he said. "I want to see your magic tree." He no longer cared if this girl was crazy. He was a bad person. And what was worse, being crazy or being evil? Plus, she might be the only girl who would even consider kissing him before he turned 30. And he was growing more conscious that he had been a dick to her. "You want to go to the woods with me?" Patricia said. "Right now." Lawrence nodded. He needed to fidget. He didn't. He thought about how dull the tiles underfoot were. Someone waxed them every day, leaving them shiny for an hour until they dried and hundreds of kids walked on them, and then the floor just looked sticky and gray with wax scum. The floor probably looked dirtier than if nobody ever waxed it. "I'm sorry," Patricia said. "I can't. I have to stay on at this school, after you've gone on to your math paradise." "Sure," Lawrence said. "Okay." He wanted to say something else, like maybe apologize, but he didn't. And then the moment had evaporated, and they were walking to separate classes. When Theodolphus Rose was 14, he'd slept on a bunk of mossy slate. He had mastered 100 ways to kill a woman without awakening the man sleeping next to her. Every morning, an hour before dawn, the 14-year-old Theodolphus had gone for a 10-mile run with a ceramic urn full of his teacher's urine on his head, and if a single drop spilled, or he failed to complete the 10 miles within an hour and a half, he would be forced to stand on his head until he saw a river of sunfire. His only meals had been the not-quite-lethal mushrooms and berries he'd been taught to pick in the thickets near the cliff-sheltered school fortress. And yet the Nameless Assassin School was a country club,
compared to Canterbury Academy. For one thing, he had been learning things, skills that he still used in his vocation, and he had taken pride in them. For another, nobody had forced him to answer multiple-choice questions on battered notebook computers. If they had given standardized tests in assassin school, he wouldn't have lasted a day. Theodolphus made a mental note to hunt down Lars Serinian, the psychologist who had studied the slaughterhouse behavior of pigs and come up with an educational regimen for human children, when he finally got out of here. Theodolphus had spent weeks spying on these two children, listening to all of their conversations, at home and at school. He'd parked across the street from their houses and eavesdropped on the two of them, together and separately. He'd racked his brains trying to come up with a death that didn't require his hands-on involvement, thus complying with the letter of child murder ban, but would still tell a good story. Something artistic. He had this notion that the children would go into the woods together, where Lawrence could be bitten by a snake, and then Patricia could try sucking the poison out of him and accidentally poison herself. But no. Because Patricia was forbidden to go into the woods, and she was the only child on Earth who obeyed her parents, Theodolphus kept hoping Patricia would have a moment of rebelliousness and being brutalized by disappointment. By now, after weeks of slouching on purpose in his office chair, listening to Brad Chomner talk about his body image issues, Theodolphus just wanted this over with. This was the longest he'd gone without killing someone in years, and his hands kept getting ideas. He sat in faculty meetings and imagined just how much of Don Gluckman's insides he could show the math teacher while keeping him alive. Worst of all was when Theodolphus had to give advice about puberty, something he had never personally experienced. Lucy Dodd got a stomach flu, not Theodolphus's work, and they needed someone to teach English for a few days. Theodolphus volunteered. It would give him another chance to study his prey, since both Lawrence and Patricia took that class. All of the kids had clearly been looking forward to having a sub so they could goof off. When they saw it was Theodolphus, wearing a crisp black shirt, matching black pants, and a red tie, they all sighed with disappointment. For some reason, Theodolphus had become the most popular faculty member at this school, and nobody felt like screwing with him. "Most of you know me," he said, making eye contact with each surly dough face in turn. Lawrence and Patricia sat at separate tables, not talking to each other, not even looking at each other, except that the girl kept giving the boy wounded little glances. The boy glared at his second-hand scarlet letter. Tracy Burt read out a passage she'd memorized with perfect diction and a smile full of ceramic braces. Then Theodolphus attempted to get a discussion going about Hester Prynne and whether she was unfairly treated, and got back a lot of canned answers about Puritan morality. And then he called on Lawrence.
"Mr. Armstead, do you think society needs to burn the occasional witch for the sake of social cohesion?"
"What?" Lawrence jumped, so that three legs of his chair left the ground. He dropped all his books on the floor. Everybody else laughed and texted.
"I'm sorry," Lawrence babbled, gathering up all his stuff. "I don't know what you mean."
"Oh, yes," Theodolphus said to himself. "You know perfectly well."
"I see." Theodolphus made a scritch on a paper, as if writing the boy off. "How about you, Miss Delphine? Do you think the occasional witch-burning helps to weld society together?"
Patricia lost a breath. Then she found it again and looked up, regarding Theodolphus with a steadiness that he couldn't help admiring. Her thin lips pushed out.
"Well," Patricia said, "a society that has to burn witches to hold itself together is a society that has already failed and just doesn't know it yet."
With that, Theodolphus knew how he would finish this mission and redeem his professional self-respect once and for all.
Chapter 9. The snowstorm hit a few weeks after Lawrence more or less stopped talking to Patricia. She woke up with Berkeley curled between her bent elbow and her shoulder and looked out her window without getting all the way out of bed. The ground and the sky mirrored each other, two sheets of white. Patricia shuddered and almost pulled the covers over her head. Instead, she took the hottest shower she could bear and put on her long johns for the first time this year. They no longer fit. Patricia's mother was already on site, and her father was multi-focusing with his laptop and a stack of folders, so at least Patricia didn't have to talk to her parents. But Roberta came down halfway through breakfast and just stared at Patricia without talking, and that was creepy. And at last Roberta went off to Ellenberg High, and Patricia was left hoping against hope that Canterbury Academy was having a snow day. No such luck. Patricia got to school in her dad's sedan and almost broke her neck on the slushy steps. People threw snowballs with gravel in them at Patricia's head, but she didn't bother to turn and look. That would just be presenting a better target.
"Miss Delphine,"
a smooth, deep voice said behind Patricia in the near-empty hallway. A lot of kids had stayed home, after all. Patricia turned to see Mr. Rose, the guidance counselor, with the knuckle face, looming in a pinstriped slate suit. Yes? Mr. Rose had never made much of an impression, though everybody said he was the only decent authority figure at this cruddy school. But today he seemed dark and towering, a foot taller than normal. Patricia shrugged this off as just snow day nerves.
"I was hoping to discuss something with you,"
Mr. Rose said in a deeper-than-usual voice.
"Perhaps you could come by my office when you get a moment. I find that I have an unusually free schedule today."
Patricia said, "Sure," and dashed off to first period. The school was half empty, and the snow kept blinding her through the windows. It all felt like a weird dream. Her first class was math, and Mr. Gluckman wasn't even trying to teach. Everybody just goofed off. Her second period teacher hadn't even made it to school, so it became a free period after 10 minutes of perfunctory waiting. Patricia drifted toward Mr. Rose's office.
"Thank you for coming on such short notice. I will keep this brief."
Mr. Rose's teeth clacked inside his dry white lips. This wasn't the Mr. Rose Patricia was used to. He sat straighter in his gray chair, hands folded on his walnut desk with its cartoon walrus pencil holder. Behind him, there was a wall of books on child development. Patricia nodded. Mr. Rose took a deep breath.
"I have a message for you," he said. "From the tree."
"The what?" Patricia felt sure this was a dream. The pale world, the empty school. She was still in bed with Berkeley.
"Well, not the tree, exactly, but the power the tree represents. I know you've waited a long time to fulfill your purpose as a witch. You've been more than patient, so I have been tasked with informing you that your wait is almost over. The secrets will soon be yours."
Patricia couldn't breathe. Her hands were gripping her chair arms. She felt hot around her face and yet freezing in her extremities. Her blood was all going to her head, as if it were preparing to separate from her body. Her feet kicked each other.
"What?"
she said at last.
"What do you mean?"
"You know what I mean."
She was on the verge of babbling, but reined it in. This was important witch business.
Who are you?"
She wouldn't have disbelieved, necessarily, if he'd claimed to be Merlin or something.
"I'm your school guidance counselor."
Mr. Rose smiled with one lip.
I'm just passing along a message, that's all. This is the only time you and I will ever discuss this matter.
Oh, okay.
You will be receiving instructions soon. In the meantime, there is one task you must perform.
Stop saying Patricia told herself. Is it like a test or an assignment? Do I have to prove myself worthy?
You have already proved everything you needed to prove. No, this is merely a task, but an unpleasant one. There is a boy at this school who will grow up to be a great enemy of nature, and a persecutor of the magical community. You already know him. His name is Lawrence Armstead. He may have asked to see a demonstration of magic recently. He may even have asked you to show him the tree. Is this so?
Yeah. This conversation was like falling off the edge of the world, plummeting all the way around the globe, and then falling off the edge a second time. Patricia's stomach was upside down.
So you already know. I hate to say this, and remember, I'm just the messenger. I regard all human life as precious and irreplaceable. But Lawrence Armstead must die, and you must be the one to kill him. Nobody else can do it. As soon as you complete this task, you can begin your training.
Patricia couldn't remember what she said after that. It probably had a lot of in it. She didn't say she would kill Lawrence, and she didn't say she wouldn't. She may have thanked Mr. Rose for the message. She wasn't sure. She was in an upright coma for the rest of the day. Even Roberta, hanging from the banister upside down and staring at her after dinner, barely registered. Roberta's dark brown hair hung straight down and her eyebrows twitched, but she said nothing as Patricia walked past. Patricia found herself in Roberta's room an hour later, right before lights out.
"Bert,"
she said, using her old nickname,
"could you kill a person, if you absolutely had to?"
Roberta was painting her toenails candy apple green in her white cotton PJs.
"Wow, Trish. Morbid much?"
She laughed. "For your information, the answer is yes and no. Yes, I would be willing, if I felt it was necessary and whatever, but I probably couldn't go through with it. I would be too much of a wuss to look at someone and take them out, even if I was sure it was the right thing."
Okay. Thanks.
But Trish,
Roberta called after Patricia as she turned to go to her own room across the hallway,
if you do ever take someone out, I get to watch. I want to see you do it.
Okay.
Lawrence was back at school the next day, in a good mood for a change, swinging his arms in the wet hallways like he owned the place. He was back to not talking to Patricia, but he smiled at her without looking right at her. She could so easily end him. Just push him in front of one of the senior citizen tour buses the school used as transportation. It would look like an accident. Patricia found herself studying his twitchy head and slender wrists, trying to imagine if it could be true. Was he going to become an enemy of magic? He was already hostile to it, that was for sure. Maybe the grown-up Lawrence could be some kind of monster, for all she knew, persecuting her kind. Maybe this was part of what witches did, regretfully, sorrowfully, snuffing out people who would threaten the balance of nature. She watched him in the cafeteria, punishing his food. She watched him running wind sprints up and down the hill behind the school, shivering in his track uniform. She tried to imagine him launching a vendetta, persecuting her friends, if she ever actually had friends. She couldn't make herself believe it, and she couldn't do it unless she did. She could imagine killing him. That was shockingly easy. One shove into the big wheels. But she couldn't imagine him deserving it. Whenever she tried to talk to Mr. Rose, he was either busy or absent. She finally caught up with him in the hallway near the teacher lounge and tried to mention the tree. He looked at her as if she was speaking gibberish, one brow raised.
At home, she asked Change Me, "Will Lawrence become an enemy of magic?"
Change Me responded, "Do you think Lawrence will become an enemy of magic?"
"I'm asking you."
"Why are you asking me?"
She couldn't get to sleep for ages, even with Berkeley scrunched along her ribcage. But then she finally slept and dreamed she was carving Lawrence open with a big knife. His skin parted to reveal a shining portal to a magical land full of kind wizards who gave her a wand of her own. She dreamed she lured him to the Wadlow River cliff where the high school kids partied and shoved him off the edge onto the sharp, slippery rocks. She woke up crying and shaking and holding on to Berkeley for dear life.
Someone threw a rock at Patricia's head before school started. Not a snowball with rocks in it, just a plain chunk of granite. Patricia ducked, but slipped on the path. Lawrence grabbed her arm and helped her to her feet. He steadied her and seemed to be trying to say something. Then he walked away, like he usually did these days whenever he was about to speak to her. First period, Patricia reached in her backpack for her textbook, and something else spilled out. A pair of panties, with a stain she couldn't identify and didn't care to examine further. She was sure they hadn't been there when she left the house. The other kids at her table, including Macy Firestone, started laughing and taking photos.
"What's that commotion?" Mr. Gluckman asked from the board.
"Someone has put something unspeakable in my bag."
Patricia tried to sound dignified, not like a victim, but not like a troublemaker either.
"Emo bitch,"
someone hissed from the corner.
"That's no excuse for disrupting my class."
Mr. Gluckman frowned between gray sideburns.
"You are taking time away from all of the children who are here to learn something."
"I didn't do anything," Patricia said. "Somebody else..."
"If someone has been storing inappropriate items in someone's bag, I suggest you take it up with the principal or Mr. Dibbs."
Patricia looked around, a room full of pure entertainment. She caught Lawrence's eye, and he gave her a blank, helpless look.
"Fine," Patricia stood up. "I will. May I be excused?"
She didn't wait for an answer. The door crashed shut behind her, failing to block out the cheers and applause. She made it halfway to Mr. Dibbs's office before Mr. Dibbs charged around a corner and grabbed her arm.
"You," he grabbed her arm with one meaty hand, "have some explaining to do."
She tried talking to him, but he hauled her right into the girls' room, where she saw, written in blood on the wall, "Death is excellent." It wasn't human blood. It wasn't fresh blood. It was definitely blood, though. Whoever had done this had left plastic containers from the butcher shop in the trash. The paint was dripping, the message still melting on the wall. Someone had gone into the girls' room and painted this right after first period began, without anybody noticing. You would have to be a ninja.
"What?"
Patricia felt frostbitten from the inside out. The stench was punishing, a noxious slaughterhouse odor, the dying distress of cattle immortalized in smell form. She couldn't bear to be in the same room with it. Mr. Dibbs's jaw twitched under his dark, thick beard. He gestured at the wall with his free hand.
"You are going to clean this up, and then we are going to call your parents to come and have a conversation about civilized behavior and barbarism and the vital, the crucial, difference between the two."
"I didn't... Please let go of my arm. You're hurting me."
She couldn't hear herself talk. He jerked her closer to the wall, so she was inches away from it.
"I don't know anything about this. Please let go of my arm. Corporal punishment is illegal in school, and you're hurting me. Please let go of my arm."
Mr. Dibbs let go of her, but he was already turning to go call Patricia's parents. They wouldn't listen to her either.
there would be three adults screaming at her instead of one.
Listen, Patricia said. Whoever did this, they did it during first period. Lots of girls went to the bathroom before first period, and there was no blood on the wall then. And everybody saw me in first period. I was the first to arrive at math class. There's no way I could have done this. So excuse me, sir, I'm going back to math class now.
Her victory left Patricia with soiled panties still to dispose of, and a classroom full of kids who kept trying to take photos of her to post on Instagram with mean comments. The blood graffiti stayed on the bathroom wall the rest of the day. The school janitor refused to go near it on religious grounds. Nobody knew what religion he was, exactly, and he wouldn't say. Patricia kept feeling as though she was going to blow chunks, as she sat in classroom after classroom, listening to the other kids whispering, and the teachers trying to carry on as if nothing had happened. She couldn't throw up if she were willing to, because the whole school had just a dozen toilet stalls for girls now, and the lines were forever. She did wait in line once to pee, and girls kept shoving her by accident. Patricia tried to talk to Lawrence once or twice, but he kept slipping away. As she reached the doorway, she noticed Mr. Rose studying her from inside the school. He'd gone back to normal size. She remembered what she'd been trying not to think about. He'd told her she'd be going away soon from this terrible place. Her training would begin. She would be free and luminous, a real witch. She only had to complete one small task.
Chapter 10. Lawrence lost track of how many conversations he overheard about the scandal of Patricia. People had nothing else to talk about as they suited up for track and field. Lawrence was field, sort of. Or studied for the big exams, or waited for gymnastics tryouts, which Lawrence was keeping Dorothy Glass company for. She hadn't yet told him to go away, and seemed to appreciate him bringing her stuff. Dorothy did this thing with her leg as she perched on the bleachers that felt personally significant to Lawrence. Lawrence had a line he wouldn't cross. He would never say anything bad about Patricia or laugh at anyone else's burn. He wouldn't sycophant his way into the outskirts of anyone's group by burning his one-time friend. Mostly, he tried not to think about the Patricia thing. She could look after herself. He was in a cocoon, pupating and incommunicado. There was nothing he could do either way. 6 months from now, if everything went to plan, Lawrence would be a freshman at the math and science school. And in the meantime, Lawrence poured every spare minute into upgrading ChangeMe, which claimed more and more space in his secure closet until he had to throw out most of his clothes. Every time he added more processing power, the computer seemed to chew it up right away. Lawrence had built a neural network with just a handful of layers, but somehow this had grown on its own to over 20 layers, as ChangeMe kept refactoring itself. Not only that, but the serial connections had gotten more confusing. Instead of sending data from Machine A to Machine B to Machine C, it was going from A to B to C to B to C to A, creating more and more feedback loops. One day, Patricia was in line next to Lawrence at the cafeteria. She looked messed up, dark hair falling into her face, circles under her eyes, uniform disarrayed, socks mismatched. And she wasn't looking at anything in particular. She didn't even notice what sort of crap they slung onto her tray. Someone who doesn't care if they get tater tots or turnip slurry is a person who has given up on life. Lawrence had a powerful conviction he should say something to Patricia. Nobody would notice. He wouldn't stand up and shout that he was on her side or anything. "Hey," Lawrence muttered in Patricia's general direction. She didn't seem to hear him. She stumbled, zombie-like, toward the desserts. "Hey," Lawrence said, a little louder. "Hey, Patricia."
How are you, like, doing?
I'm doing, Patricia said without looking up.
Cool. Cool,
Lawrence said, as if she'd ended that sentence with an adverb.
Me too. Me too.
They went their separate ways. They were both eating alone. But Lawrence had the privilege of eating alone in a secluded nook of the cafeteria, behind the milk pumps with their sawn-off rubber tubing. Patricia, meanwhile, ate alone in a dim corner of the library, behind the geography shelves, where Lawrence barely noticed her when he dropped off a book on his way to class. She was so shrouded, she looked like Batman. At home, Lawrence studied his parents, who had forgotten that he'd yelled at them for being defeated by life a few weeks earlier. Lawrence's dad kept complaining about his car sound system, eating his CDs. There was an article online about problems with the aerospace company that Isabel, the rocket scientist, was helping to run. Launches getting canceled over and over, minor accidents. He read it 3 times, cursing each time. Lawrence got a letter saying he'd been admitted to the math and science high school for the fall. He kept it on his dresser, next to his grandmother's old ring and his 3 different combs for different parts of his head. And he looked at it every morning as he got dressed for school. The 2 crinkly folds in the papers started to look like the lines of Lawrence's palm after a while. Lifelines. One night, Lawrence was already in his PJs, but he wound up on his hands and knees in front of his closet, staring at the skein of crossover cables running between all the jury-rigged parts of Change Me. The instructions had gotten much more numerous and complicated than Lawrence could possibly understand, covering eventualities that he couldn't envision. And Change Me had thousands of accounts on free services all over the world, where it was storing data or pieces of itself in the cloud. And then Lawrence noticed something. Every time Patricia had one of her conversations with Change Me, the computer's code base took another exponential leap into greater complexity right afterward. Maybe just a random correlation, but Lawrence kept staring at the dates and times of the logs and thinking about Patricia breathing life into his machine while he was blowing her off. Lawrence found Patricia on the front steps the next morning. She stared at the school, maybe trying to decide if she should even bother. "Hey," he said, "I just wanted you to know that I got your back. I don't think you're a Satanist." Patricia shrugged. Her dark hair had grown longer, so it almost ran into her jumper. "Why would anybody be a Satanist anyway? I don't get it. You can't believe in Satan without believing in God, and then you're just picking the wrong side in a big mythic battle thing." Everybody else had gone inside. They were ringing the second bell. "I guess if you're a Satanist, you believe that God is the bad guy, and he rewrote history to make himself look good."
"But if that's true," Patricia said, "then you're just worshiping a guy who needs to get a better PR team."
Lawrence and Patricia sat together at lunch. In the library, but not in the dark corner, because there wasn't enough space for 2 people in there. Lawrence tried to ask Patricia about how she was dealing, and she just shut down, like the whole topic of conversation put her in a coma.
"Maybe," Lawrence said, "maybe you should talk to Mr. Rose."
"What?" Patricia snapped out of her daze, her eyes wide open. "Mr. Rose, the guidance counselor. You said you thought he was cool."
"I can't talk to Mr. Rose,"
Patricia said under her breath, barely audible, even in the quiet library.
I think there's something not right about him. He said something seriously crazy to me just a couple days before the bloody wall happened, and I keep thinking there has to be some connection there."
Lawrence had to lean so close to hear what she was saying, he nearly took her nose out with his chin.
"What did he say?"
Lawrence whispered. Patricia thought for a moment, then shook her head.
"I can't even repeat it. If I told you what he said, you would think I was making it up."
I would believe you over Mr. Rose,
Lawrence said, and meant it.
Not about this, Patricia said. Imagine if you said something to someone that was so crazy, nobody would ever believe you had said it.
This was worse. This was driving Lawrence round the bend.
Just tell me, he said. It can't be that bad.
But the more he pushed, the more she clammed up, until she had gone back to coma mode. Whatever Mr. Rose had said to her, it had messed her up more than a ton of kids accusing her of being a cutter and blood painter. They ended up sitting in silence until lunch recess was over, and then they had to hustle their trays back to the cafeteria.
"Let's go to the mall after school," Lawrence said, as they dumped their trays.
"We can tell your parents you're at my house, and my parents that we're doing something outdoorsy. It'll be like old times."
"Sure," Patricia shivered. "I could use some hot chocolate, with like a million marshmallows."
"Let's make it happen."
They shook on it. Lawrence felt like he'd removed a splinter that he'd forgotten was even jabbing into his skin. He walked to science class alone.
Brad Chomner lunged out and grabbed the collar of Lawrence's uniform jacket and lifted him with one hand, so Lawrence's armpits scraped.
"You should have left the emo bitch alone," Brad Chomner said. He swung Lawrence like a shot put and let go.
Chapter 11. Snow turned everything gray, as far as Patricia could see. Even the forbidden woods near the spice house looked washed out, with their dark tree shapes covered with 3 storms worth of snowfall. Patricia never left the house now, except to go to school, so the cold came to seem much worse than it was. Mythic in its ability to freeze the life out of you the moment you left your front door. Patricia sat in bed, talking to Change Me, or reading the stack of paperbacks she'd gotten from the big library sale. She curled up with Berkeley in just a corner of her bed, making a warm space with her comforter and spare blanket. Berkeley hadn't gone near Roberta in months, and protecting this cat might be the one achievement of Patricia's life. Patricia had started flunking most of her classes, though she was still trying her best. She'd never had to hide report cards from her parents before. Since the wall of blood thing, there had been a couple other incidents, including an obscene Barbie tableau in the girls' locker room and a stink bomb in a big garbage can. Nobody could prove Patricia was responsible, but nobody doubted it. When Lawrence had talked to Patricia in public, he'd gotten the crap kicked out of him. Her craziest days, Patricia sat in class and wondered if maybe Mr. Rose had been telling the truth. Maybe she was supposed to kill Lawrence. Maybe it was him or her. Whenever she thought about killing herself, like with a ton of her mom's sleeping pills or something, some survivalist part of herself substituted an image of killing Lawrence instead. And then just the thought of killing, the closest thing she had to a friend, made Patricia almost throw up. She wasn't going to kill herself. She wasn't going to kill anybody else. Probably she was just going insane. She'd imagined all this witchy crap, and she really was the one leaving messed up shit all over the school. It wouldn't surprise her if her family had managed to drive her nuts. Pretty much every conversation between Patricia and Change Me began the same way. Patricia wrote, "God, I'm so lonely." To which the computer always replied, "Why are you lonely?" And Patricia would try to explain.
"I think Change Me likes you," Lawrence told Patricia as they slipped out the back of the school, handling the big metal door softly as a baby, so as to make no sound on their way out.
"It's good to have someone to talk to," Patricia said. "I think Change Me needs someone to talk to as well."
In theory, the computer can talk to anyone, or any computer, all over the world.
Probably some types of input are better than others, said Patricia.
Sustained input.
Yeah, sustained.
Snow crisped every inch of the world, making every footstep a slow descent. Lawrence and Patricia held hands, for balance. The landscape shone like a dull mirror.
Where are we going? Patricia asked.
The school was somewhere behind them. They were going to have to turn back soon if they were to have any hope of making it to the ceremony, at which the five top-scoring seniors were going to recite memorized passages and talk about what the Serenian program meant to them.
I don't know, Lawrence said. I think there's like a lake back here. I want to see if it's frozen over. Sometimes if a lake is frozen the right kind of solid, you can throw rocks at the ice and it makes a natural ray gun sound effect, like pew, pew, pew.
That's cool, Patricia said. She still wasn't sure where she stood with Lawrence. They'd hung out, furtively, a few times since their lunch in the library. But Patricia felt like both she and Lawrence knew, in the deepest crevices of their hearts, that they would each ditch the other in a second, if they had a chance to belong, really belong, with a group of others like themselves.
I'm never going to get away from here. Patricia was knee-deep in snow. You'll go off to your S&M high school, and I'm going to stay and lose my mind. I'm going to be so socially destroyed I'm going to turn radioactive.
Well, said Lawrence, I don't know that it's possible to turn radioactive, unless you're exposed to certain isotopes, and in that case you probably wouldn't survive.
I wish I could sleep for 5 years and wake up as a grown-up. Patricia kicked the frozen dirt. Except I would know all the stuff you're supposed to learn in high school. By sleep learning.
I wish I could turn invisible. Or maybe become a shapeshifter, Lawrence said. Life would be pretty cool if I was a shapeshifter. Unless I forgot what I was supposed to look like, and could never get back to my original shape, ever. That would suck.
What if you could just change how other people saw you? So, like, if you wanted, they would see you as a 100-foot-tall rabbit with the head of an alligator.
But you'd be physically the same? You'd just look different to other people?
Yeah, I guess.
That would royally suck. Eventually, someone touches you, and then they know the truth. And then, nobody would ever take your illusion seriously again. There's no point, unless you can physically change.
I don't know, Patricia said. It depends what you're trying to do. Plus, what if you could make people see or hear whatever you wanted and just mess with people's perceptions in general? That would be cool, right?
Yes. Lawrence pondered for a moment. That would be cool.
They came to a river that neither of them remembered having seen before. It was covered with a white layer, and the jutting rocks looked like the fake sapphires in the necklace that Roberta had gotten Patricia for Christmas. The river current kept the water from freezing, except for a layer of frost.
Where the hell did this come from?
Lawrence poked at the brook with his foot and broke a tiny piece of its shell.
I think it's really shallow, and you can just step across it most of the time, Patricia said. The rocks are easy to walk on, except when it's all icy like this.
Well, this sucks.
Lawrence squatted down to examine the river, nearly soaking his butt on the slushy ground. What's the point of ditching school if we can't make laser noises on the ice?
We should head back, Patricia said.
They headed back. This time they didn't hold hands, as if getting stymied on their expedition had left them divided. Patricia skidded and fell on one knee, tearing her tights and scraping off some skin. Lawrence reached down to help her up, but she shook her head and got up on her own. This was a metaphor for how it was with Lawrence, Patricia realized. He would be supportive and friendly as long as something seemed like a grand adventure. But the moment you got stuck or things were weirder than expected, he would pull away. You could never predict which Lawrence you would get. You couldn't count on Lawrence, Patricia told herself.
You just couldn't. And you should just get used to that idea. She felt as though she had settled something, once and for all.
I think being able to control other people's senses would trump everything, even shape-shifting.